Joan Wilder and Jack Colton journey to Africa to stop a power-hungry tyrant. Join us as we talk about unnecessary sequels, blowing up an F-14 with a single bullet, and red flags that the guy you just met is a dictator. Then we find out if the Jewel of the Nile stands the test of time.
Test time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? James says Gladiator with a glut. Alan says as a father, blah blah. It's the test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today? Test of time, James and Alan have their say. Do the movies you love still hold up today?
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Test of Time podcast. My name is Alan Noah, and I am joined by the jewel of the podcast, James Brief.
Aw, thanks, Al.
Yeah, no problem.
I don't know what to call you. Well, I guess I'm the jewel. I don't have anything to say back to you.
That's fine. That's okay. I can live with that. But today we're talking about The Jewel of the Nile. I had never seen this movie. I had never seen last week's movie, Romancing the Stone. We didn't mention it last week, but Romancing the Stone was one of those movies that had just been sitting on the list forever, and it was the 40th anniversary, so figured why not? And you kind of wanted to watch the sequel, too.
Yeah, you know, I figure if we're going to do this, it's let's see both of these films. You know, when we talk about sequels, there's certainly sequels that have every reason to exist.
When you say reason, you're talking narratively. You're talking about the story.
Exactly. Like Star Wars ends and this Darth Vader character flies off. There's still more story to be told. Luke has learned this mysterious thing called the Force, and he might one day be, what's it called, a Jedi like his father? And there's more story to be told there, so you want to find out what this is. You know, you have Godfather 2. You know, now there's the next story of Michael, the next generation. You have Aliens, which is not just a single alien, but now there's multiple. It's the whole race of them. Sometimes there's other sequels that were they necessarily necessary? Or are these films just made because, you know, not narratively, but financially, it kind of got to do it?
I think that's the thing that they always say. They being whoever is on the couch of whichever Jimmy they are on for a late night talk show, whether it's a writer, a director, a star, they always say, I'll do a sequel, but only if the story is right. Only if it's a story that needs to be told. And I get your point, because some stories end and you can very easily imagine further adventures with these characters. Sometimes it's a blatant cliffhanger begging for a sequel. But even when you don't do that, you can just see how some movies, there's more story to tell. And plenty of times there's just not, and they make the sequel anyway, and you can usually feel that in the sequel, that like, yeah, we didn't really need this.
Yeah, but then again, sometimes there's Creed that comes out. Ryan Coogler had a movie that had, there was no reason to make this film. There's no unanswered stories about Apollo's unknown son that we had never heard of, but he was able to make a film that, wow, I mean, it got Sylvester Stallone an Academy Award nomination, and he won the Golden Globe Best Actor, Supporting Actor.
Well, I think this is the opposite of a hot take. This is a very cold take, but most sequels aren't necessary. Most sequels, I think, are just cash grabs. And now that is sort of what Hollywood is. So many movies are just designed to be a franchise, not even just a franchise. Franchises are fucking old news. Now everything needs to be a cinematic universe. I mean, they're not going to make a Beatles biopic. They're making four separate Beatles biopics, and they're going to be their own cinematic universe. Like, really? What the fuck? Why? Because that's sort of the model that everything's going for now. And yeah, I think that it is okay to have a story that has a beginning and a middle and an end, and for that end to be a fucking end. Like, that's okay. That's allowed.
That's fair, but in the end, I've said it so many times, if you make a good film, we'll like it. You could say the Terminator 1 was, all right, it's a story, it's enclosed, they defeat the Terminator at the end, that's it. and they make a sequel that comes by.
But that's a perfect example, because at the end of Terminator, you can very easily imagine James Cameron, Gale Ann Hurd, the people who wrote it, thinking, yeah, but what happens after this?
Well, there is that arm that survives. What happens to that arm?
Right. And so answering those questions is the joy of being a fucking writer. Like, that's the fun part, is ending a story. And if there is more to tell, then yeah, going back to the well, sure. But then Terminator 2, Judgment Day, ends that story definitively. And then they just made more for no fucking reason other than they wanted to make money, and they like having pools filled with money and diving into those pools like Scrooge McDuck. And I don't blame them. That sounds nice and fun. But narratively, story-wise, there's no fucking need.
Right. And that kind of leads to this film, because Jewel of the Nile, there's a reason for it to be made. Well, the number one reason for it to be made was because Romancing the Stone was the top 10 film of 1984.
Right.
So you make another sequel. There's a reason to make another adventure with these characters. However, these characters are not archaeologists or treasure hunters. They're just regular people. Kathleen Turner is, she's a writer. Michael Douglas is a former bird smuggler. And at the end of the first film, he's now a rich guy. So there's no specific reason for them to have another adventure, but adventure finds its way into their lives again.
Yes, but I would argue that this movie does have a good initial premise, which is that they have their happily ever after. What happens after the happily ever after? What happens when your happily ever after isn't so happy? I think that's a really interesting place to start this movie. So for anyone who hasn't seen The Jewel of the Nile, this movie reunites novelist Joan Wilder and adventurer Jack Colton. Now, Joan and Jack find themselves bored with their globe-trotting life, leading Joan to accept an invitation to Africa to write the biography of a charismatic but mysterious ruler named Omar. Ralph finds Jack, looking for revenge, basically for everything that happened in the first movie. A man named Tarek tells him that Omar has the Jewel of the Nile, and he needs to be stopped. The Jewel is a holy man who could prevent Omar from taking over the region. Joan escapes from Omar's palace with the Jewel, reunites with Jack, and thwarts Omar's nefarious plot. So I'm guessing that this movie didn't do so well at the box office because there was no third movie in this franchise.
Well, I'm going to tell you, there were two things I knew about this film before I got into this, or two things I thought I knew about this film. One is that this was the big flop that killed the franchise. And two, the first film was way better than the second one, which is why it flopped. And the first film, to remind you, that wound up making $76 million domestically. This film wound up making $75 million domestically. Same thing. Okay. $96 million worldwide. It opened on December 13th, 1985. It opened at number two with a $6.6 million haul. And yeah, wound up going to $75 million, which is actually really not bad. That's like 11 or 12 times multiplier.
That's not a flop.
No, it really isn't. Romancing the Stone had a $10 million budget, and this one went up to $25 million. So it was financially a success. Michael Douglas, he produced the film. I'm sure he made a lot of money from this.
Right, and he wanted to make this movie not just because he was a star, but because he was a producer. Kathleen Turner was not interested in coming back for a sequel, specifically not this script. She really didn't like the script. She didn't like the fact that Diane Thomas, who wrote the first movie, wasn't brought back to write the sequel. She was busy working on another movie that we just reviewed with Courtney. She was working on Always. So that's why she wasn't able to come and write the sequel. Robert Zemeckis didn't come back. He was busy working on Back to the Future. And so Kathleen Turner was like, nah, I'm not going to do this. And the studio had to threaten to sue her, or maybe they did sue her to get her back. But then when she showed up on set, she was still like demanding rewrites of the script. And she and Michael Douglas were like working on the script together. Like, they had three different versions and they were picking and choosing pages from the different versions. You do kind of feel like the sequel was kind of cobbled together. Also, just the fact that this movie comes out in 1985 and Romancing the Stone came out in 84. It's like a year and a half later. That's really fucking fast.
It's funny you mentioned the fact that there are so many versions of the script, because I felt that this film was, in an Indiana Jones way, it was very, very episodic. There was this car chase, and then this chase, and then this airplane chase. It advances the plot a little bit, but we have a 10-minute action sequence to do what you're trying to do.
I think that is fair. I would even say that this movie, more than Romancing the Stone, feels more Indiana Jones-esque because of that, because it feels more serialized, right? Like, that's what George Lucas was doing with the Indiana Jones movies. It was those old serials where you watched a couple of minutes and then come back next week, kids. Then you see another thing that, you know, advances the plot just a little bit. And this movie does have a lot of those, but I do agree with you that they do get really tiresome really, really fucking quickly. And kind of going back to what we were talking about earlier, again, I think this is a great place to start a movie. They have everything they ever wanted. Now what? And Joan is bored. She's writing a romance novel that doesn't work. She has no inspiration. You know, and this is a thing that many artists and creative people, writers, comedians, whoever say, that the really best art comes from when you're suffering and when you're miserable. And when you're really happy and things are going your way, the art that you make is sometimes not as good, which sucks, you know, which sucks for the artist. A musician can have a really terrible year and make an amazing album, and then their life gets better, and then their music sucks. Like, that's shitty, but that is a thing that people talk about. So I'm invested in this movie. I'm invested in this story. I'm invested right out of the gate. But only for a very short time, because then all of the characters make really, really fucking stupid decisions. Joan's bored, so she goes off with a stranger who is very clearly a dictator. I mean, he is super shady right out of the gate. She knows nothing about him. Yes, this is before the internet. Yes, it's before she can Google him. But he's shady, and she should know that right away.
Oh, actually, I would maintain that she does know something about him. She says that she read about him in Time magazine, and it's implied this was not a positive article about him, because he says something like, oh, well, Western journalists don't quite understand what I'm trying to do in my regime.
Okay, yeah, I mean, the sheer fact that he says he has a regime, I would say, is a pretty big red flag.
I don't know if he says that word, but okay. It seems like she's going off to, you know, just be with this guy who she's read is not a good guy.
Right. So that doesn't make any sense. Colton is like kind of pissed about his wet blanket girlfriend. He wants to go to Greece by himself because he has like a friend there who is expecting him or something. That doesn't make any fucking sense. Then Ralph shows up, the Danny DeVito character, and he's mad and he blames Colton for every bad thing that ever happened to him. Which doesn't make sense if you just watch the first movie, because the person who he should be mad at is his cousin Ira, who, I said this last week, this guy Ira is kind of one of the main bad guys, but not really. Who the fuck is he? Who's the actor? I don't know. Who's this guy? He's not intimidating. But Ira, his cousin, leaves him. At the end of the movie, Ira leaves Ralph, and then that's why Ralph gets caught at the end of Romancing the Stone. But at the beginning of the sequel, he's just mad at Colton, which doesn't make sense. So all three of these main characters have motivations that make zero fucking sense.
I mean, I guess I understand why he's mad at Colton, and that he's one of these guys wrongly blaming someone for kind of his own predicament or what his cousin did. He's shifting the blame to Colton, because also Colton got away with the diamond, the emerald and everything. So he's pissed off. But what I remember thinking is just, why is he in the sequel? I mean, he just shows up. I don't know. I mean, I guess I didn't need them to waste time with it, but they kind of could have shown him like being released from jail or something. And what are you going to do now? Back to America? No, I got some unfinished business. Something cheesy, I know, better written than that. But he literally pops out of a dumpster when Colton's like, everything is going real well in my life. Oh, yeah, Colton, here you go. And actually, Colton's like, hey, it's you, the guy from Carnega. And as in, like, you're right, Al, like, he didn't necessarily have any hard feelings to this guy,
right?
Weirdly, even though I guess he could have tried to get him killed. There's a reason why Danny DeVito could be in it, but they don't give us the right reason. He just pops out of a dumpster.
Right. That is emblematic of this movie in general, which is all of these things are happening. Why? Because. because we didn't hire the screenwriter from the first movie, because we didn't hire a good screenwriter to write this movie, because we threw this movie together in a year and a fucking half, that's the real reason why.
Yeah, you know, the opening number, it's basically the same thing as the opening number of the first film. It's one of Joan's romance novels. And in this one, she's finally getting to marry the man of her dreams, this time in the fantasy played by Michael Douglas. And so, you know, it sets up the same premise as the first film, which I think is kind of a cool trope that, you know, later life imitates art, and then they kind of set that up. But I absolutely loved Michael Douglas's hair in the pirate scene. He almost looks like one of these Lego character wigs with the plastic hair. He's got this just fantastic 80s blow-dried hair. Do you know what I'm talking about? Do you remember what it looks like? It looks fantastic. Like, it's just so 80s romance novel.
I was going to say, it looks like Fabio, like the cover of a romance novel.
Right.
Which makes sense because she is a romance novelist. That opening scene sets up marriage. They are not subtle with that theme throughout the movie, where once Joan discovers that the jewel is a person and she said that she's going to help him, and then Colton finds them and he's like, come on, just ditch this guy, let's go and, you know, go this way and go to safety. And she says, no, I can't, because I made a commitment to him and I'm going to honor my commitment. And like, yeah, marriage, we get it. I mean, the fact that the movie ends with them getting married is not at all surprising. I mean, they are foreshadowing the shit out of that right out of the gate.
Right. And the fact that the movie is called The Jewel of the Nile, and the first film is romancing the stone, and the stone they're trying to find is this large emerald. I did kind of appreciate the fact that they're not actually trying to find another jewel, and that the jewel turned out to be a person.
When did you figure that out?
I think maybe when he said, what, doesn't he reveal he's the jewel?
Yes, he does. But before that, there's a scene where Ralph is talking with Tarak and his tribe of good guys, I guess, where he's asking about the Jewel of the Nile. How big is it? Is it as big as an orange? And they laugh. And then he says, ah, so it's bigger than an orange. And I'm like, okay, it's not a diamond. It is not a thing. My first thought was that it was going to be a concept, like it's love or something. And then when it turned out to be a person, I was like, okay, well, at least I was right that it wasn't a stone. I just felt like they weren't going to do the exact same MacGuffin twice, that they were going to do some kind of spin on it. And that conversation with Ralph made me think that it was something.
And, you know, this is the second film that we reviewed where the MacGuffin, what we think is some kind of object, turns out to be a person. Do you know which other one I'm talking about?
Oh, I feel like that happens in a lot of movies.
It does happen in a lot of movies. It happened also in, I believe, Men in Black 2. I think Rosario Dawson is like the person they're trying to find instead of a jewel or something.
Okay.
But
it's happened in some Marvel movies.
I'll give you one hint. It's said in this very interesting voice. I think I'm saying the right word. Travel pass.
No, it is. You're thinking of The Fifth Element, and the word is shit. Wait, hold on. Give me a second. Fuck. What is it? It's not travel pass. What is it? It's I can't remember. I say it all the fucking time.
I got it. I was wrong. It's multipass.
Multipass. Yes. Okay. There you go.
She's The Fifth Element.
Right. Mila Jovovich. Right. It was a fine enough twist. Also, though, the guy, the Jewel of the Nile, he is a holy man, but in the movie, he's just silly. And, like, he kind of makes some funny jokes, funny with air quotes. Like, he calls Joan just Joan because she says, oh, you don't need to call me Joan Wilder. I'm just Joan. Okay, just Joan. It's a lot of dad jokes. It's a lot of corniness. And, you know, I would expect a very holy man to be a little bit more dignified. And maybe he speaks a little bit more seriously. And this guy's just kind of a clowny kind of character.
I didn't mind that he was a clown. One thing that wound up being interesting is that you mentioned earlier that this film was more Indiana Jones-like than its predecessor. But there are definitely supernatural elements in this film. Like, in the end, I think he really might be the real deal. He might be an actual holy man. There's a part in the desert where I can't tell if he's just doing kind of a trick to be a metaphor like Mr. Miyagi might do, but he asks Joan to pick up this rock, and then she picks up the rock, and then she squeezes her hand shut, and then she opens it, and she's like, things aren't always what you think they are, and she opens her hand, and it's a butterfly that flies away. Like, did he do a trick? I mean, that's something a magician, a street magician can do. It's sleight of hand. But is he supernatural? The whole point of this film is that this bad guy, Omar, he's trying to pretend that he's the jewel. And the jewel apparently can do supernatural things like walk through fire. And in the end, this jewel guy can do it.
It's really interesting you say that. I interpreted that scene in the desert as a rock that he knew there was a butterfly or an insect in it, or it was a cocoon or something that looked like a rock. I interpreted that as he was just kind of making a point without doing any real religion. And the very end, that's interesting because, yeah, he hires this rock and roll pyrotechnic guy, Omar does, to prove to his followers that he is the real deal.
I like that premise, actually. I think that's kind of cool. It's trying to do some technology to prove to people that you're a god.
Yes, but the problem is that at the end, when the jewel does walk through the fire, it is so shitty green screen that I couldn't even pay attention to what was happening and be like, oh, is he really walking through fire? Or is this guy just on a fucking soundstage and there's a green screen behind him, which is what it really is. It looks so shitty that the magnitude of this question that you're asking, which is a valid question of is he really magic or is he not, is just so fucking lost that I don't know and I don't care because the effects were that fucking bad.
The effects are that bad, and they could have done something better than this.
Yeah.
Or they could have even had his clothes smoking or something like that, or falling off or something like that. They could have done a lot of things. I think it's supernatural. I think you're supposed to think it really was the fire.
Okay, fair. But going back to that pyrotechnic guy, I hear what you're saying about that that could be impressive. But the thing that annoyed me was that character also just feels like very cartoony, where he's like, don't worry, baby, I'm going to do all the effects and it'll knock your socks off. Wubba, wubba, wubba. It's just like straight out of Central Casting. It's really cheesy. When we first meet that guy, he's talking with Omar and they are doing so much exposition loudly as they're walking through the palace, which is just for the benefit of us, the audience, and Joan, who's sneaking around and hearing every word that they say about, hey, now listen, the reason I hired you to do this elaborate stunt show is to make all of these people believe that I am religious. Yes, sir. And I am going to do that by blah, 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 blah. It's like so fucking stilted, such shitty exposition-y dialogue. Again, I'm just like, what the fuck is this?
I mean, I get you with the exposition. We had to find out what it was. The thing that really bothered me about that guy, it was the wardrobe. Like, I get he's the British punk producer of pyrotechnics, but he's wearing like a thick red leather jacket in the desert. Like, it just doesn't fit. I get he hires some Westerner guy.
But then why is Omar keeping the real jewel of the Nile prisoner? So if he needs to unite these different regions in Africa, they don't really fully explain any of this, but the jewel of the Nile, the actual jewel, is a threat to him, which is why he was kidnapped. But if he was really a threat and the only thing that could stop him from consolidating this power, and Omar is a very, very, very bad man, he's a dictator, he kills lots of people, shouldn't he just kill him? Like, wouldn't that solve all of his problems instead of keeping him alive over and over and over again throughout the whole movie, when he does the thing at the end where he has Joan and Colton hanging over this pit of rats with acid? Colton even says, why don't you just kill us? And he's like, oh, it's from her book. Okay, I guess there's some kind of logic in that. Not really.
But
why does he walk away? And then also, why doesn't he then just shoot the Jewel of the Nile? Because that guy is still a threat. He doesn't need him around for any reason. There's no logical, you know, oh, but it's poetic because it's from the book. No, no, no. Just shoot him, right?
I mean, it's one of these things where if he wants to get, like, the power of the jewel, he could very easily say, I need him alive for the ceremony or whatever, if they're going to go the supernatural element of it. I was thinking the same thing. Why isn't this guy dead? But I didn't think he should have killed him. I think the much easier thing to do is explain why he can't kill him.
Fair.
Maybe something better than what I just thought of. But there's a reason. You know, another part that I couldn't quite get, is this comedic or is this supernatural, is when Joan and the jewel are trapped in the jail together, she immediately grabs a stick and she's like, I'm going to chisel our way out of this this jail and we're going to break out. And the jewel's like, no. And he just like removes the cage from the window. Is it comedic or is he magical? It's not explained. I think it's supposed to be comedic in that one.
I think so. What does he say? Like it's erosion or something? Do they say it in this movie? Maybe they do, maybe they don't, but I've definitely heard it in some movie where they say that, like, being in the jail cell isn't really the prison. The prison is the desert. You know, like, even if you break out, where the fuck are you gonna go? When they do break out and there is that scene in the fighter jet, I was really bored by that because that scene goes on way, way too fucking long. And here you really kind of feel the script trying too hard. That happens a couple times in this movie, but Joan's yelling at him to shoot the bad guys, and Colton says, well, it's not Space Invaders, and then he pushes some buttons and blows up some things, and then he's like, actually, it is Space Invaders. Get it, audience? That's really funny. Like, it's really fucking forced. It's not that funny. And then he just, like, destroys this fucking town. He blows up everything. There's lots of good guys and bad guys, just like in Romancing the Stone, everyone shooting each other. No one ever gets hit by any bullets. But even still, Colton, the good guy, is destroying this fucking town. Even if Omar is bad, and even if a lot of the people in this town work for Omar and they are therefore bad, which, you know, there's some logical leaps there too, but like, he's just destroying shit left and right. And yay? Like, we're supposed to be cheering for him? Like, he destroys a market. He doesn't have to. The plane never takes off, which is also weird. I mean, I get it. He doesn't know how to fly it, so maybe he doesn't need to, but it just kind of feels like if you're in a plane, we should see them take off.
I was thinking the exact opposite. I was like, do not let this guy take off in an F-14. Maybe a Cessna, you can guess and figure it out. But come on, it's an F-14.
Well, Cessnas don't have that much firepower.
I'm talking about the ease of somebody like faking it and, you know, pulling the stick and, you know, the yoke and you know, going up.
I'm just saying it in kind of like a Chekhov's gun kind of a way, where at a certain point you're in a fucking plane takeoff.
Yeah, it's not like a tank that they find and they're able to escape. It's a weird getaway vehicle. I just also think nobody can get a shot on these people. I don't know how bulletproof it is, but couldn't they shoot through the glass of the cockpit? Maybe it's bulletproof. I don't know. But it just seems like, can't you take out the tires? Or it's not exactly driving fast.
That plane gets shot a lot while they are escaping and they're fine. But then when Colton decides that he wants to blow up the plane, for some reason, I don't even remember what the reason is, he fires one single bullet at it from a very, very far distance, and then the plane blows up, which is also stupid because then, you know, Omar is able to find them from the cloud of black smoke. But how the fuck did that work? How did that one bullet blow up the plane when all of the dozens and dozens and dozens of other bullets didn't?
You're right. There's no reason for him to blow up that plane, but if they did, it could have easily been some kind of Molotov cocktail that they could have constructed and thrown it in.
Yeah. And then speaking of things that don't make sense, then they encounter this other tribe. They call them the Nubians. This is another scene that goes on way too fucking long. But the joke, said with air quotes, is that they assume that Colton and Joan are married. They are not. And so therefore, the leader of the tribe decides that Joan will marry his son. And Colton thinks the son is like this cute little precocious kid. But no, it's this big, huge adult. And they have to fight for her. And this really plays into some shitty negative stereotypes about, you know, the big black man stealing the white woman. And it's supposed to be this comedic fight, between Colton and this guy. It's not really funny, I don't think. It goes on way too long.
I just didn't like it that Colton is getting his ass kicked. And then when the guy is kind of like happily, he defeated Colton, Colton takes a complete cheap shot, grabs a jar and smashes it over his head.
Yeah, that's true. And then the entire premise is negated in the very next scene when there's like this dance from these women in the tribe. And the Jewel says to Joan, in this tribe, the women choose their partners. They choose their husbands. It's like, oh, well, that's interesting because, you know, tying into the theme of marriage, which they're beating you over the head with this whole movie. But then it's like, no, because just 2 minutes before, the chief was picking her to be the bride of his son. So what the fuck?
Yeah, that is weird. And there's a weird thing where right when they meet the Nubians, the Jewel says, uh-oh, I was hoping to avoid these people. But they're actually lovely people. They're right. Like the only strange people that they encounter that are nothing but nice to them.
That's true. And if the Jewel is a holy man, he should know that and have faith in them or whatever.
Yeah, like he just didn't need to say that line. He could have said, oh, Nubians, we're saved. But then a jump smash cuts to, you know, Colton being held by knife or something for not being married. Yeah, it could have been something, but they just weirdly say that they're to be feared and then they're lovely.
Yes, that is a very, very good point. The thing I kind of liked about that scene was that it shows Joan and Colton reconciling, which I kind of felt like was missing from the first movie. You know, like they kind of have the fight and then they're just back together again. But here in this movie, they have this big fight at the beginning of the movie. Then they reunite, but they're still fighting. They're still at each other's throats. They're still debating about, should we save the Jewel? Where should we go? How should we do this? Whatever. And in this scene, they rekindle their love and they have sex. And it's like this great moment. And I was like, okay, I appreciate that they took a minute to invest in the love story. But then right after that scene, Colton finds out that the Jewel is the guy because he thought it was like, you know, an actual diamond or something. And then he gets really mad at her again. And it's like, oh, God, now we got to do this shit again. And they kind of sort of resolve that again later. But it's unnecessary. I think like at that point, they were fighting. They are reconciled. Yay. Now they just deal with Omar and the Jewel and all of that. They don't need to keep going back and forth with though they love each other, they hate each other thing.
Right. And not only is he mad that it's not a real Jewel, but he's already stupid rich from the first film. And you know what else is coming to him very soon? A fat insurance check is coming to him because his boat was blown up. Presumably he had insurance.
I was going to say, I don't know about that. That boat blew up. I would not bet on this guy having insurance.
Well, that was stupid of him.
Sure. But I mean, he's an exotic bird smuggler.
You'd think that Joan would be smart enough to get insured. But, you know, he shows up with that boat in the first film. So you're right. Maybe he was stupid.
Yeah, I think he's maybe poor again. All of his money and everything he had was on that boat. I could buy that.
You know, it actually bothered me. His entire life is his boat. The whole first film, his goal in life is to get a boat. And he gets it in the end. So there's, you know, the first film ends happily ever after. And he, in the beginning, says, no, I'm not following Joan. I'm going to live my life here. I'm going sailing. And then behind him, boom, the thing blows up. And Colton's like, my boat blew up, didn't it? As if he was expecting it.
Yeah, it's stupid. I feel like we kind of already talked about all of the things that happened at the end with like the rats and the acid and the big reveal. Oh, actually, you know what? There's one thing we didn't mention about the end. In this movie, Colton does save Joan. In the first movie, she does not need him. She saves herself. But in this movie, Colton kills Omar right before Omar presumably would have killed Joan. So here it's the damsel in distress thing. He saves her. I guess it's less bothersome because she saved herself in the first movie. So this time it's his turn, I guess. You know, it's not just pure sexism of the guy saving the girl, but it's still anticlimactic. All of the effects are stupid. Also, the good guys are there to stop Omar from performing this ceremony. And eventually they do. And, you know, they have Ralph with them and then they go into the catacombs and they rescue the Jewel and everything. But they're standing there staring at the pyrotechnic show for a very long time before they go and like, oh, actually, now let's go and find the Jewel. So maybe those pyrotechnics were really fucking good.
Presumably they were, but they just came off poorly on the green screen that we saw.
Right.
Yeah, I have a question about Ralph. So he is the bad guy in the first film. And
one of
the bad guys. He is definitely a bad guy for most of the second film. I must have missed it. What exactly is his turn that makes him want to save Colton? There's the part where they're almost going to fall from the acid on the ropes into a bath of, what is it, acid bath?
No, it's rats. The rats are going
to rats, okay. And he doesn't save them. They get saved, luckily, because he trips and accidentally knocks a ladder over that saves the two of them. But later, Colton is about to die, and Ralph sends a big crane over to save him, and he does. He totally saves the day. I wasn't sure why he did that.
So Ralph saves Colton and Joan accidentally by tripping, and then he is like tied up because of the way that he fell down or whatever. It's stupid. Right. But then the jewel says, you are not acting appropriately. The Sufi tribe made you a member of them. You are a member of the Sufi tribe and you are not acting like a member of the Sufi tribe. And that is what gets through to Ralph. That is his turn. Then he becomes a full-fledged good guy and he wants to go and help Colton after that. Now, the reason that maybe that didn't stick in your memory is because, well, he's a bad guy and we've seen him be a bad guy for almost two full movies now, and then this holy man wags his finger at him and then he changes from bad to good. That doesn't make any sense, but that's what happens.
Right. I guess there should have been more of a epiphany at that scene where he's being made into a holy member. Like he says something like, I only want money. And maybe he realizes money isn't the pursuit, something like that. But I just didn't get the personal motivation. Like, does he really believe he's part of this tribe? Because I'm fine with him turning. That's fine. He could be a good guy.
But maybe that goes into what you were talking about earlier, where the jewel really is a holy man and he really does have some power. Maybe not even just like a spiritual, mystical power, but, you know, like any good rabbi or priest or minister, his words are really powerful and he can move you and he moves Ralph to change his life. I mean, it's just with a handful of words. Does he give him something too? Maybe is there like a symbol from the Sufi tribe? At the end of the movie, they give him like the knife, which is encrusted with jewels. So then, ha ha ha, now he has something that's worth something. I'm not sure if he gives him something before then too. But yeah, that is his turn. It is paper thin. You are correct about that.
Yep. So 1985 is The Jewel of the Nile, the sequel to Romancing the Stone. Does it stand the test of time?
No. Definitely not. This movie is far, far worse than Romancing the Stone. It's bad. It's just really bad. And I don't think either of us used this word when describing Romancing the Stone, but that movie is way more okay. You know, it's not great, but it's more middle of the road. This movie is painfully bad. It was tough getting through it, even though it's like only an hour 40 minutes or so. It's not long, but it feels like a drag. It felt like a chore to get through this movie. Even though I like Kathleen Turner and I like Michael Douglas and I like Danny DeVito, it felt like they didn't really want to be there. It felt like it was a chore to them to be there. So no, I really didn't enjoy anything in this movie. I said this before about how nothing makes sense. The fact that Joan is a novelist, a romance novelist, and then Omar's like, oh, well, you're going to write my biography. And she's like, yep, sounds good. I can do that. Maybe she can, but that's a very different kind of writing. One line of dialogue of like, oh, well, I did that internship in college where I did something. Like, oh, okay, sure. But no, she's just a romance novelist. And then her publisher's there and she's like, okay, bye. Like, what? What the fuck? Like, it's really contrived. It's really stupid. Also, this movie does have a lot of shitty white savior elements in it, where there's just a lot of brown and black people who are fighting and killing each other. And guess who saves the day? The white people! Yay! I mean, that's not like the point of the movie, but it's definitely fucking there, which is just another reason to roll my eyes. As we were talking about sequels at the beginning of the episode, one thing that I will say does not stand the test of time that you see in this movie is that, yes, there are so many sequels now, they happen all the fucking time. they are not thrown together as quickly as they were with this movie. A year and a half for a sequel, that doesn't happen anymore. And that's a good thing. Even though we live in a world where there's just a constant glut of sequels and remakes and reboots all the fucking time. I mean, they just said that the Super Mario Brothers movie is getting a sequel. What year did they say it was coming out? 2026?
Yeah, well, that's animation. So that's going to take a while.
Very, very good point. But even still, they could have been like working on that on the sly before.
Horror franchises do that a lot. They just churn sequel after sequel. I think there was like a Saw every year for a while.
Okay, fine. I guess for a big budget live action movie, not a horror movie. So I'm putting some asterisks on there. But I think usually there's more respect to the fact that these things take time. Also, maybe that's just because of special effects, you know, like doing all of these, the CGI effects just take more time. But no, I do not think this movie stands the test of time. I'm guessing you agree with me, James?
Well, I thought that the MacGuffin in this second film, the jewel being a person and maybe supernatural, but they didn't really go far enough with that. I thought it was a little sillier, but I don't know. I mean, I kind of like the serialized version of this film that it was just adventure after adventure. I kind of like the idea that the first film was very green in the jungles, and the second film was in the desert. And presumably, if they made a third film, it would have been something with the water, maybe in, you know, an old European city or something. Who knows?
There was talk about a third film that there was going to be called something of the monsoon. So okay. You were right about that.
Yeah, there could have been a reason for a third movie because this film was, I thought it was very similar to the first one. A little worse. I did think there were some parts that were a little worse. I really didn't think it was that different. I was really, really expecting a couple weeks ago when we decided to do these films, I was really expecting, wow, what a great first film, a great adventure. And then, oh man, what a stinker of a sequel. I didn't think it was that bad. It was a bad movie, but you know, it's not leagues worse than the first one. I agree with you that the first film is okay. This one's a little worse, making it eh. But they're both kind of forgettable films. That's what it is. I'm shocked that both of them made as much money as they did. And I don't think this film stands the test of time. Only because the first film doesn't really either.
Yeah. And yeah, there was talk about doing a sequel soon after this one. And then that didn't happen. And then they were talking about it, you know, in the early 2000s. And then it was going to be a TV show. It was going to be a reboot. Katherine Heigl was going to be the female lead. And that never happened. And it wouldn't surprise me if in another couple of years, it gets new life and they make it and it becomes a rebooted thing.
I think a remake is better, you know, tighten up the jewel parts, make it a little more treasure hunty. Probably change some of the bad guy elements. And it's an adventure film. You can make this thing. Just make it good.
But then also, kind of, again, to the point from the beginning of the episode, just make a new adventure movie with new characters. Like, do people really need to see more of Jack Colton and Joan Wilder?
Exactly. Except for the name recognition. That's the right. Only reason you would take it.
Well, that's the only reason why they ever do a reboot or do something with an established property.
Hollywood has to have a bunch of these spec scripts of some random adventure. Just tweak it and it becomes Romancing the Stone. No one remembers this film enough to be like, wait, that's not the character. You know, like when the new Star Wars came out, that's not my Luke Skywalker from the 80s. I just don't think people remember these films enough that they would remember the name Romancing the Stone, but all you have to do is make an adventure film in the jungle and people will go back to it.
Yes. All right, well, that's going to do it for us this week. Next week, we are going to be talking about Go, directed by Doug Liman. It's having its 25th anniversary. So, yeah, let's watch Go. Let's go for Go. And you should go to testoftimepod.com and find all of our old episodes. You should talk to us at Test of Time Pod, Facebook, X, Instagram, and Threads. Let us know what you think about Romancing the Stone and The Jewel of the Nile and Kathleen Turner and Michael Douglas and Danny DeVito and all these guys. We love hearing from you. And we'll see you next time, everybody.
Bye.